Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Narda Zucchino, former deputy editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, and your moderator for tonight's program. We also welcome our listeners on the radio and invite everyone to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Mr. Anthony Bourdain. Anthony Bourdain is a famous chef, fantastic writer, adventure traveler, and totally entertaining personality. Of course, you all know that already because you've paid money to come and hear him speak, and you wouldn't be here if you didn't know that. I understand tonight I checked Craigslist before I left my house, and somebody was offering to pay $200 for tickets to this event. No, you can't leave back there. people have come from as far away as Los Angeles and Chico and I don't know where else, but to hear him. Tony's remarkable life is chronicled in 363 entries, 37 pages on Google.com. But the sheer volume of words there doesn't really even begin to touch the kind of man that this is. You have to really read his books to get a peek into his soul. Bourdain has spent more than half his life in restaurant kitchens, doing every job from dishwasher to prep chef, line cook to sous chef, and finally executive chef at several restaurants, currently at New York City's Les Halles. His career has survived addictions to drugs, as well as the idiosyncrasies and idiocy of various bosses over the years. And he regales you with those stories in his book, Kitchen Confidential, which I'll get to. He's a graduate of the Culinary Institute of America and some of New York City's best and worst restaurants. He gained a lot of attention in 1999 when he wrote a New Yorker article, Don't Eat Before Reading This, an expose of New York restaurants. He had already written two crime novels, Bone in the Throat and Gone Bamboo in the 90s, and later wrote a third, The Bobby Gold Stories, and a nonfiction book, Typhoid Mary and Urban Historical, which he did that in 2001. The New Yorker article led to his memoir, published in 2000, Kitchen Confidential, Adventures in the Culinary Underbelly, which is a bestseller that is still well-read today. Around that same time, Bourdain set off across the world on a culinary tour to more than a dozen countries, resulting in a new book appropriately called A Cook's Tour in Search of the Perfect Meal, which became a bestseller in the United States and the United Kingdom and won the Guild of Food Writers Award for Best Food Book of the Year. The Food Network broadcast a companion program, A Cook's Tour, as a 22-part series, one memorable episode in which he swallowed the still-beating heart of a cobra. Bourdain's most recent hit was the Travel Channel's No Reservations, a three-season series in which Tony and a crew travel to some of the world's most interesting countries to explore their culture, cuisine, and libation. In a legendary Emmy-nominated episode from Beirut, Bourdain and his crew struggled to accept the reality that they were caught in the middle of an Israeli Hezbollah war zone with no way out until they were rescued by U.S. Navy and Marines. And, Tony, there were thousands and thousands of grateful readers and fans that you were rescued. That particular episode is very gripping, and he writes about that and all the other adventures in a book, No Reservations, which is, can you hold that up? Is the travel, I mean the companion piece. Thank you. The companion piece to the series. I'd like you now to welcome Mr. Bourdain.
Thank you very much. This is really, it's a scrapbook. It's pictures that my crew took as we traveled around the world. I guess most of you know, I have the best job in the world. I get paid to sit around with four of my closest friends, three of whom are usually holding cameras. We'll have a couple of cocktails, look at a map, and decide where do we want to go, and what do we want to do when we get there, and how are we going to tell a story about the experience when we get back? I have a you know, if you don't like one of the episodes of this program, there's really no one to blame but me. I have as much creative control as anyone has ever had in the history of television, as close to final cut as anyone has ever had in the history of television. And in the cause of entertaining myself, well, I like to say that if I have, I don't have a lot of virtues, but if I have one, if I have one virtue that I'm pretty confident is indeed a virtue and that I feel pretty good about, it's curiosity. I'm curious about this world. And this is a job that enables me to satisfy my curiosity about what I found to be an amazing planet, and a very big one, and at the same time sometimes a very small one, but always an interesting one. And you know, one of the ironies of this television career and the cruel bitch goddess we call television, it's that I try to have a good time. I mean, I'm not going to these countries to be snarky. I went to Iceland with an open heart, free of prejudice, I hope, to what I thought was, you know, the party center of Europe. You know, I had a miserable time. You know, I like to say I have the freedom, among other advantages, unlike most travel hosts, I have the freedom to look at the camera and say, this sucks. and it did. It really did. unfortunately, my pain, misery, and humiliation often leads to what my crew laughingly refers to as comedy gold. And apparently a fair number of you like to see me in serious discomfort. Which is why I imagine the famous Uzbek massage scene in the Uzbekistan episode was such a hit with the viewers, you know. And I will tell you that, you know, this is an honest show and that I tell you how I felt. We're not misrepresenting events, but there are nightmare sequences, you know, druggy dream sequences, sort of dramatizations, which in many ways are often more the truth than the nonfiction, in the sense that that's the way it felt to me. Uzbek massage scene being an example. Okay, those bone-snapping sounds, we dubbed those in later, but I heard them in my head, believe me. And as I mentioned in here, you know, there I am being straddled by a mostly naked guy in a Speedo, twisting me into positions that no human body should ever be twisted into. And, you know, I realized, looking back, and this is, you know, I don't know, for better or worse, this is one of the things that, you know, you can get from a book that you don't get from television. I mean, looking at the freeze frame now of this picture, I don't know where it is. I'm pretty, you know, and I'm looking at myself, it looks like a frame from Midnight Express. And I realize, you know, the sheer physical agony, press my face down into this sweaty towel, you know, trying to muffle my own screams and not sound like a little girl on the show. But all of this pain at least had the useful function of making me completely oblivious to the sexual humiliation component, which was considerable, I have to say. I've been a lot of really great places. I'm flipping through this little scrapbook now and looking at the I wrote the commentary, so I'm not reading it, but I'm looking at the pictures, and of course there's a long story behind, you know, everyone and a lot of memories, and I'm thinking of all of the, you know, the random acts of kindness and generosity from people who often had very, very little, all of the times when just being, I think, open to the experience led to once, you know, so many once-in-a-lifetime experiences, so many never-in-a-lifetime experiences, so many pinch-me moments that I never, 7, 8 years ago, standing behind a stove at Layal, could ever have imagined would happen to me. And I like to attribute this, by the way, to the difference between cooking and eating, and I think it's true for travel as well. Cooking is about dominating the situation. It is about being in control, about controlling the physical forces of the universe, the behavior of your fellow cooks, to whatever extent possible, manipulating the perceptions of the dining public and their environment to create, to control everything, hundreds of things that are going on simultaneously in a professional kitchen. Eating, however, and I think this is illustrated very well by if you watch professional chefs eat, eating at its best should be an entirely submissive act. It should be about letting go completely of control. And it just, you know, chefs don't walk into restaurants and just good restaurants of colleagues and say, I would like a steak and I'd like, no, they say, what do you have? Feed me. You know, what are you good at? That's what I want. What's good tonight? And in much the same way, travel, ideally, or the kind of travel I'm trying to do, is largely submissive. It's about putting yourself again and again in a position where hopefully good things happen to you. If you're micromanaging the situation, you're not going to have a good time. And it's also rude, let's face it, which is the problem I have with vegetarians. How do you travel? How could I have ever seen what I've seen in this world had I cut those relationships short early on by saying, well, no, I'm sorry, I can't accept your offer of duck or chicken or local specialty. You know, despite the fact that you are a poor farmer, you have only so many ducks, and that this duck dish represents 6,000 years of accumulated wisdom, trial, error, cultural history, personal history, techniques painfully acquired through starvation, oppression, slavery, and displacement. You know what? You know, I'd prefer a spinach salad. It just seems rude. And it seems foolhardy. I mean, listen, I like living a long, healthy life. I like a clean colon as much as anyone. But it's just not that important to me compared to a limited amount of time in, say, Thailand. I want to eat everything in sight. I am humbled by the experience. I am damn lucky to be there. I am not going to arrive in Thailand or China, you know, a far more advanced and older culinary culture, and say, you know, well, it's like walking into a museum and saying, you know, I will only be looking at paintings in the color red today. Just, I'm not doing that. As I said, I've had a lot of experiences, met a lot of people around the world. Often, you know, you have to re-examine let's put it this way, in the kitchen, it's a world of moral absolutes. You're either the very best waiter ever to walk this planet. You know, you're the best. You're my best friend. I want to bear your children. Thank you for selling all my cod specials. I love you. Or you are the worst, most miserable rat bastard in the universe. I hate you. I want to go to the funeral and kill anyone who shows up to mourn you. This was the way I used to think. But you travel the world. Certain words you thought you knew meanings to, you know, take on new meanings, and certain things you were sure of, you're not so sure anymore. It is a world of gray areas, and it's a world where I've met a lot of really, really nice people who've at various times in their life done very bad things, and I've tried to, you know, accept them for who they are at the table. And by the same token, I met a lot of really, really good people who, no matter how good they are or what they do, are still crushed under the wheel for, you know, bad things happen to good people. Which brings me to thoughts of good and evil, and I think about that a lot, which leads me to Ina Garten, good or evil? Ina Garten, good or evil? What do we think? I'm going to take it in a formal poll. Good. Ina Garten is good. See, I surprised you there. Why? Because she can really cook. I may not want to spend the weekend at her Weird's Hampton house with her friends. I doubt we'll be going on long vacations together. But when Ina Garten makes mashed potatoes, for instance, on her show, you can be damn sure that she's doing it right, that she's taking the time to boil them, you know, maybe slip off the jackets, through the ricer, whip it, you know, don't go light on that butter, you know, whole cream. You know, she's not telling you you can buy potato buds at the supermarket and add boiling water and be fine. No, she raises expectations. She actually teaches you something. And in that sense, she raises expectations. She is good for the world. She's good. Mario Batali, godlike, walking Buddha as far as I'm concerned. You know, changed the landscape of cooking. Volto Mario, you got a full lesson in cooking, ethnography, geography, obscure rock and roll B-sides, you know, the works of Marcel Proust and how great Mario is, as he'll be the first to tell you. Good for the world. Emeril, Good for the world. Yes. The world's probably a better place post-Emeril than it was pre-Emeril, right? I don't like the show either, but... he looks like Escoffier now compared to some of these other characters. And, you know, he created a real restaurant empire. He's a working guy. He again, raises expectations. But Sandra Lee... I don't think there's any question there. I think we have gate when you look at her glassy Linda Kasabian squeaky Frome stare. I think we know the nature of true evil, don't we? It's the mantra that says, "Hey, just throw cheese on it, it'll be good." You know? On that note, why don't we... Rachel's too easy. And you know what? You know, you could really drop a nuclear weapon on New York, and if one person climbs out of the rubble alive, it will be Rachel. So, you know, she scares me, you know? You know, I don't want to be driving along in my Land Rover and see her charging at me from, you know, it's like... It's a hard-working woman, you know? So she can't cook. Well, you ever see the Iron Chef with her versus Giada? Giada got so robbed, man. Rachel was, like, stirring that same sauce for, like, 45 minutes. Well, what are you going to do? Anyway, I thought we'd open the floor to questions.
All right. Can we... Is this on, this mic? There we go. Yeah, I'll throw out all the Rachel Ray questions then. There are a few people want you to talk about your warthog experience.
Yeah, why? What's the matter with you?
Or not.
All right, I will. I try to be polite, okay? I'm grateful to be an honored guest in a lot of cultures different than my own, and I do my very, very best to appear grateful and grateful for the experience even when I'm not particularly enjoying the food. I call it the grandma strategy. I may not like grandma's turkey, but I will say thanks, grandma, and I'll have some more. In this case, I found myself in a remote part of the Kalahari Desert with a tribe of Bushmen who, they're not hunters. I mean, pardon me, they're not, they don't grow anything. They're hunter-gatherers. And when they're lucky, every once in a great while, they are, with extremely primitive bows and arrows, able to take down an animal like a warthog, which they then butcher and cook. And water is something at a premium in the Kalahari, so proper food handling and cleaning is something that you don't see a lot of. Which is to say, I found myself sitting there with the chief in front of his tribe. And remember, their entire social hierarchy is based on he who brings meat and she who distributes meat. Which is to say, I could not refuse what was about to be offered, which was... a roughly hacked open and chopped up warthog, its interior, including its reflux and excrement, scooped out by hand and deposited next to me, thrown into the sand and cooked in the fur. And as honored guest, I was offered the last foot of unwashed, undercooked poop shoot. My beliefs about hospitality were tested that day, my friends. For there was fur, sand, and crap in every bite. And if you look closely at the finished episode, you can see I look like, you know, this plaintive look in my eyes. I'm looking past the camera at Chris, my executive producer, just saying, please, God, have I been polite enough? 2 weeks on antibiotics, by the way, and I was good as gold. And I find it really disturbing that you really wanted to know more about that, but...
It's clear from the questions, by the way, that these people have really read your books. So. What is something funny that happened to you that you couldn't put on the air?
Well, let's see, something funny that we couldn't put on the air. You know, that's the thing. We put pretty much, yeah. If it's funny, we're exactly. We're putting it on the show. That we're merciless to the camera crew. Like if you get a leech on your ass or smash something or clumsy or mess up or you know, create some sort of, you know, awkward social situation, the cameras turn around and they're on you. Poor Tracy here, our producer and director, got a leech on her ass in Malaysia in the jungle. And, you know, she's screaming, yanks down her pants, and the cameras turn on her right away, instinctively. And her underwear was inside out. It was so, it was gold, I tell you. So there's really not much that's, you know, amusing that's in there. I mean, if we're just criminally babbling, drooling drunk, or the ayahuasca thing. You know, technically, I'm not supposed to, according to network standards and practices, I'm not allowed to do anything that's actively illegal. So, you know, in the Jamaica show, you might see smoke coming, but you're no actual contact. You know?
Thanks. A number of people want to know what you had for dinner or what you're going to have for dinner tonight.
I had a pulled pork sandwich that was excellent. Ate it in the car on the way here. I'll probably be having some, like, you know, $34 peanuts out of my mini bar later. I'm a little bitter about it because I really want to go to House of Prime Rib. I love that place. I love that dinosaur era kind of, you know, indifferently prepared gravy, you know. Roast beef and Yorkshire pudding. I want that so badly. I need that. In order to get it to my happy place, I need that dish, and I don't think I'm going to get it.
Okay. Some people want to know how you would compare Lafayette to Uzbekistan, but I don't think we need to go there.
You have meat on a stick here? Murat was right about Uzbekistan, by the way. I'm just saying. Yeah.
A number of people ask about whether you have any intention to open your own restaurant, or are there any exotic foods that you've discovered in your travels that you'd like to serve at the restaurant? Or
right.
Those questions.
You know, life's good right now. I'm traveling around the world, doing pretty much whatever I want. I'm actually paying my taxes on time. I'm not behind in my rent. Why do I want to go and fuck it all up by opening a restaurant? Now, I'm asked a lot, but, you know, have you ever considered if you actually still worked regularly at Leal, which I don't. I mean, they still call me the chef there, but you won't actually, you know, see me there much. We call that the Rocco DeSpirito strategy. were I to work there regularly, would I, for instance, be using some of the picking up some influences around the world? Here's my feeling on that. In Thailand, they've been cooking this food for 6,000 years. I'm going to spend 2 weeks there and go back to my restaurant and start throwing red curry paste around. Isn't that a little arrogant? You know? A sushi, I know that the sushi chef at my favorite sushi restaurant spent 3 years working as a trainee, as an apprentice, allowed to touch nothing other than rice. What can I possibly add to those incredible cultures and traditions, you know, in my 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 3 months, or 3 years for that matter? I'm happy to eat this food around the world. I am not so arrogant as to think that I can somehow make it better or, you know, I'm just, so no. You know, yeah. I took me my whole career to learn old school French brasserie bistro. That's probably what I should have been doing my whole career. A lot less people would have been hurt.
Yeah. Here's someone who calls you the Hunter S. Thompson of the restaurant culture. I think that's a compliment. And they want to know why you keep apologizing for a great book.
Wow. I'm going to be flattered by that because Hunter Thompson was a hero to me. When I read Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas at age 12, serialized in Rolling Stone magazine, it was like a religious awakening. It was a tremendously, tremendously exciting to read prose that electric and passionate and hyperbolic and visual. You know, he was certainly a role model to me. You know, it may be not the best role model at age 12, you know. But I certainly did everything I could to, you know, emulate him. You know, I, you know, on the other hand, you know, I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be, you know, you're not going to see Kitchen Confidential 2, 3, 4, and 5, right? I won't be wearing the same leather jacket in 5 years. And, you know, I'm not going to be picking up heroin again or cocaine anytime soon. So, and hopefully, you know, I won't kill myself. I think his best work was a long time ago. You know, I think to me, you know, he's as much a hero and an influence as a cautionary tale, to be to be honest. You know, I don't want to be, you know, I would prefer not to be a caricature of myself in 5 years. Thank you very much. Okay.
Somebody wants to know, what were the most, what were you the most humbled by in during your travels?
Oh, well, you know, it happens. It happens regularly. You know, just these little moments that that come at you. Sitting in the Mekong Delta in Vietnam quite a while ago, and as a guest of a duck farmer, and just having, you know, hearing footfalls in the dark, people coming from neighboring farms just to kind of touch my arm and meet the American and talk. And a lot of these guys are former Viet Cong, and to be treated and their kids and their grandkids and to be treated with so such open hearts was really jarring to me. To be so welcomed, to be an object of, you know, real pride and delight that I was there. That was a really that moment was a very powerful one. You know, you're humbled anytime you see someone who is working so hard, you know, as to defy the imagination of anyone, of most people, you know, living in the Western world. I'm humbled by the sheer technological advancement and even superiority of what I've seen in parts of China and Hong Kong and Singapore and Kuala Lumpur. I mean, if you think you live in the most advanced country in the world, well, not for long. I'm humbled by that. You know, it happens a lot. You really have to reexamine. Travel writers tend to in seeing the world, you know, you're forced to look inwards at yourself, and of course that happens all the time.
Somebody wants to know about your recent trip to New Orleans. If you'd talk about that.
Wow, that was a really interesting show. We went down to do a show in New Orleans, concentrating entirely on the restaurant hospitality business and how it's been affected and how people in it dealt with it. And I got to tell you, if you think New Orleans is fixed and back on its feet, it's not. It is really screwed up still. And, I mean, it's an amazing place. It always will be. And it is filled with – it makes the people even more remarkable, considering, you know, what they've done, particularly in the restaurant business. The people went back and just started serving food immediately under insane conditions. You have to be kind of nuts to – you know, the restaurant industry is down like 40%. We went into Antoine's, and it was empty. There were more employees. The employees have been there sometimes 30, 40, 50 years. There were more people in the kitchen than in the entire restaurant. And most heartbreakingly, every single person we talked to on camera at some point during the conversation burst into tears. It was as if an entire city had a simultaneous nervous breakdown and was still recovering. And I think the sense of disbelief, of betrayal, is you know, something that well, I, you know, I hope it fades, but it was quite. I hope it's a really powerful show about a really extraordinary place.
Hmm. When I watched the Beirut show, I was kind of moved by how you know, you all seemed very apprehensive and somewhat frightened and all that, and that was totally understandable. But how you dealt with that by going into the kitchen to gather all this food and cook a meal, that was there was something very calming about that for you and something very grounding about that. Do you miss that life of, you know, being on the line or cooking?
I mean, I guess it was a time of great uncertainty, you know, and you look for constants in your life, you know, in much the same way. You know, people ask me a lot, you know, do you miss cooking professionally? And, you know, life is good now. I don't miss standing on my feet 14 hours a day in a hot, sweaty kitchen, you know, talking about dick with a bunch of cooks, you know. you know, I'm old now. I'm not physically up to the job. You're not getting any better at professional cooking after age 37, whatever they may tell you and whatever you may want to believe. It's hard in there. But I do miss the certainty of sitting at that bar after work, of knowing absolutely your place in the universe, how well you did that night. You did 300 meals. Every single one was well-received. Nothing came back. The waiters are happy, made good tips. The other cooks are looking and saying, you know, good job tonight, Poppy. You have a couple of drinks after work. You know that the take for the restaurant is good. You go home feeling like a titan, absolutely certain of how well you did. No other aspect of my professional life can reproduce that, not TV, not selling, you know, a lot of books. It's always kind of ephemeral. And it's much the same way, you know, at a time when I was, you know, when are we going to have phone service in an hour and stay and be able to stay in touch with our loved ones? Will the embassy ever call? Mm-hmm. How will this end? Will it get worse? To know that, you know, braised lamb will still react in the same way when you apply heat to it, that felt good.
What are your thoughts on sustainability and the slow food movement, which, of course, is very big here in the Bay Area? And do you think these trends will affect how food is produced in the world?
That's a great two-part question, because, first of all, I think the whole sustainable movement is and slow food movement are really important. I think they're really enormously valued. Anything, like Ina Garten, anything that improves expectations and people's, the dining public, awareness of food, what makes food good, is a good thing. It is wonderful that we have these options as fairly affluent people to buy organically produced or carefully produced or sustainably produced artisanal foods. But I think that the whole world will ever, you know, go this path? We can't. You need the guy from Slow Food. He was right about the ferry, you know, the market. You know, it's a lot of wealthy white people there, okay? Mm-hmm. Let's not kid ourselves. The idea of going without fertilizer for somebody who's struggling to crank out as many crops as possible in Southeast Asia or in the Amazon, you know, hey, pretty to think so. I like Whole Foods just fine. You know, I don't like paying a dollar for a lemon, but, you know, I'm glad I can. Okay? And most of the time, that dollar, that expensive, organically produced, sustainable lemon tastes better than the other kind, but not always. You know, a greenhouse tomato can indeed taste better than an heirloom. And my personal opinion is, as a chef, I don't see myself, you know, other chefs feel very differently, and other chefs who I respect and I'm very glad are around, like Dan Barber, who's really championed this sustainable and regional. I don't care if my tomato causes the occasional tumor in lab rats. I just want it the best ham tomato there is. I am not your dietitian or your ethicist. As a chef, I was in the pleasure business. You know, I was there to give you the best, tastiest, most enjoyable meal I can, and my only other responsibility is to maybe increase the likelihood you're going to get laid after dinner. Beyond that, you're on your own. Right? I'm glad they're there. They're good for the world. I support them. Their interests dovetail with mine a lot. But if you're telling me that there's only one, you know, one tuna still out in the ocean and one big hunk of fat belly meat, you know, some nice otoro of the last bluefin, I'd like to get in on that one. Okay.
A number of people comment about your how your show is. It really shows your respect for cultures all over the world and for cooks all over the world. And somebody wonders, first of all, there was one question, if you would you accept a nomination to be Secretary of State? This shows the desperation of some of us in the Bay Area. No offense. No offense to you. but let me ask you, is there somebody wanted to know if there is an international chef's culture?
Oh, without question, it is a timeless. The restaurant business has always sort of organically attracted similar personality types throughout history. You know, misfits, refugees, people who are strangely uncomfortable with the 9-to-5 world, sensualists, people like immediate gratification, a world of extremes, an island of order in the middle of a sea of chaos. We all seem to, anyone who cooks in any culture seems to get each other on a very, and understand each other on a very nonverbal, very immediate way. I think that just by virtue of, you know, cooks, whether they're professionals or not, anyone who truly loves to cook food. And I'm not talking about, you know, do food nerds around the world connect in the same way? I don't think so. I think the difference between a foodie and somebody who really loves food, you need to love the people who cook the food, not just the food. Neither exists in a vacuum. But yes, there is not just an instinctive feeling for each other and appreciation for anyone who cooks well, but there is an actual international chef kind of mafia. I mean, we're always two phone calls away from, you know, at this point, chefs travel so much that, you know, if I'm going to Shanghai or a friend of mine, even the line cook at Jean-Georges in New York, let's say he's planning a trip to Lima, somebody in his kitchen knows somebody who knows the best chef in town and is getting him a reservation there like that. So it's good to be a chef.
One of our audience members said that they watched your Argentine episode, and they said that you seemed very visibly affected by the separation of the calves from the mothers. And they wanted to know if that affected you in terms of your eating habits or how you view meat.
You know, I think that shame and discomfort should be part of a meat-eating experience. You should know what's involved. I think it's useful for chefs who, you know, it's very easy to become separated from where our food comes from. Nothing reminds you of that more acutely than seeing a screaming animal die. You know, it's just that simple. I felt extremely uncomfortable and guilty and ashamed and horrified. You know, but this is, you know, this is where meat comes from. I can live with that on balance, you know, and I will live with it. I am going to be less likely to waste. You know, Thomas Keller talks about respecting the ingredient. You know, for better or worse, we have decided, or it has been decided for us, due to our rather intelligent design to run after smaller, stupider creatures with our long legs and bring them down with our fingernails and eye teeth and eat dumber, slower, more delicious creatures. Given that, you know, we should at least respect the ingredient, and I think I'm certainly less likely to waste, and I hope more likely to cook well and to do the very best with every little bit.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people want to know what you're going to make for Thanksgiving or eat for Thanksgiving, but let me just turn that a little bit. Do you cook your own Thanksgiving meal?
No, I'm
what are you
letting
do?
Someone else do. I'm a guest over at my publisher's house. She's doing the turkey, and you know we're doing the whole traditional thing. It's all about the turkey, man. Mm-hmm. More significantly, it's about the leftover turkey the next day. That's the best.
Is that sort of intimidating to cook for you?
I mean, I am so easy. Make me a good meatloaf. I'm happy. I'm really happy. I don't want some little stack of, you know, oh, Tony, so glad you could come over. We have a little stack of, you know, pan-seared foie gras with some, you know, quince chutney and a drizzle of reduced balsamic. I want to kill myself. You know, it's like, that's work, you know.
How did the presence of your cameras and your crew change your experience in the cultures where you were or when you were having your meals? Did it change anything?
Well, this is why we insisted from the get-go, unlike most travel shows where they want you to have the superior quality, then superior quality, picture quality beta cams, which are those big over-the-shoulder rigs. We only travel with little digital cameras, no lighting equipment, no boom mic, no sound guy. It's very shoot and scoot. It's interesting. In a lot of the cultures where it's most important that we don't, you know, when you bring in a big crew, everybody freezes up. Welcome to my village, you know. We don't want that. My crew, we go in, we all, a lot of places like in Borneo, and we stayed with the Aban tribe of former headhunters, and you know, we're all sitting there getting hammered under a bouquet of human skulls. They don't make the distinction between people behind the camera and in front. So all of the time, and it blows the shot, people will, in the middle of the meal, offer the cameraman a shot or insist that they eat. They're constantly saying, come sit down. So we do. You know, the few minutes you see in a scene represents often 6 hours of heavy drinking and eating with the whole crew. So by the time we're shooting and we're getting that kind of heartwarming stuff, it's not like an invading army of weird American television professionals. It's annoying relatives with cameras, you know? So it takes a lot of time and a lot of drinking to get that balance. It's something we're really aware of and try to not, you know... You know, we're very aware of the change in dynamic.
Okay. Somebody wants to know about the increase in the growing popularity, I guess, in shows about chefs and about cooking and restaurants and that sort of thing, and whether or not this is going to affect the profession. And there's a question, I'm sure I'm going to relate to that. It's sort of rhetorical. Besides bad cooking show hosts, what scares you? but the question about... whether these shows are going to somehow affect the profession?
I think these shows have already affected the profession. I mean, the obvious question is, do all of these, you know, are there a lot of knuckleheads rolling into professional kitchens now who want nothing more than to be celebrity chefs? They don't really want to cook. They saw Amarole or they saw Bobby Flay and they figured, I want to do that. Of course there are. But, you know, they forget that Bobby and Emerald worked, you know, started at the bottom and worked 20, 30 years to get where they are, you know, in real kitchens. The business will shake those people off, you know, very, very quickly. You know, really, it'll take a few weeks. It's, wait a minute, people are mean to me in this kitchen. And cleaning squid in a cellar is not glamorous. And what did the chef call me? I've never heard that word. It has changed the dynamic in the sense that cooking well is no longer enough. This is a very competitive business, and increasingly, and bizarrely, because in a business where most people were attracted to it because they had poor communication skills, now good communication skills are a real asset. It is almost required that you are able, you know, should the 6 o'clock news come to do a 3-minute feature on your restaurant, it's nice to have the chef be able to talk about it intelligently in a way that would make you want to actually eat there. We are already seeing media training classes in culinary schools. You know, I hate the idea, but you know, Escoffier was a hustler too. He was. You know, he had a cookbook line, and he was a brand. You know, as was Carême. So I guess this is just the world we live in. What scares me? You know, I mean, I have nightmares of, you know, TV personalities with enormous heads chasing me with low-quality cookware. They're screaming little catchphrases at me like Sammy's and Evu and whatever.
Somebody wants some dirt from Top Chef. Do you have
dirt
any?
From Top Chef?
Yeah.
Sure. Come on. Hung totally deserved to win. Come on, right?
Yeah.
He did. Okay, here's some dirt from Top Chef. The judging is totally honest, okay? It is so not bent. It really angers me when I read on the web, you know, they only kept Casey around because she's blonde and looks good, or, you know, the whole judging process is rigged because it'll be more dramatic later on. You know, I would love to see someone actually try to tell Tom Colicchio to change his opinion of someone's cooking because it'll make a better story later. In fact, one of the joys, I'm a total fanboy, and one of the joys of going on that show is, first, it's like, you have to understand, it's like we argue over who wins and who loses for like 3 hours. You only see a few minutes of judging table. But what is fun to see is when the producers' faces when Tom sends home, like, you know, someone who the audience loves, you know, it's like, oh, not Trey, oh, no. Oh. You know, our ratings just took like a serious dive here. Or, oh, not CJ, man. He had testicular cancer, dude. It was a great, you know, it was a great human drama. You know, there are certain characters that reality show producers, of course, want to see last a lot of episodes, but they do not dare even whisper that. They just suffer silently, if somewhat visibly. And I enjoy that. Listen, the worst food that week gets you sent home on Top Chef. The best food, you win. And the best chef won last season.
Can you tell us about your upcoming Christmas special?
Oh, my Christmas special. you know those old Bing Crosby specials, right? The network foolishly asked for a couple of specials in between regular shows. And I said, yes, and we have some very creative ideas for you. Those old Bing Crosby Christmas specials were like Bing would be standing in a really artificial, like, you know, stage set, supposedly in Connecticut with fake snow in the background. And the doorbell rings. And, oh, look who just happened to stop by. It's my neighbor, David Bowie. And so I wanted to do one of those. So we rented a house in Connecticut, and I invited my family to join. And we hired a couple of decorators with glue guns, really. We shot the whole thing in August. We did a propaganda film for foie gras and why it's the nicest thing or the second nicest thing you could do to a duck. And it's really good. It's like there's scenes of the happy ducks in the pan. It's like, you know, hold on there, Quacky. There's plenty for everybody. Don't shove the little guy. And we have musical guest Queens of the Stone Age who volunteered to come on the show, flew cross country, put on the ugliest Christmas sweaters you can imagine, gave us original score, like scored each segment of the show with original material, and sat down to a turkey dinner, which I prepare on camera, showing you all how to prepare turkey like a professional. And we all sit down and eat together, at which the bloodshed begins. And yeah, it should be pretty wild and disturbing. That's all I can say.
What food do you absolutely hate?
I hate truffle oil. I hate truffle oil. It's just, you know, it's the ketchup of the nouveau riche. It should be banned in restaurants. More truffle oil doesn't make it better. It makes us all forget what a damn truffle tastes like. And it's not food. It's maybe the most overused ingredient, and I think it should be taken away from all responsible cooks until they prove they can use it.
The other side of that question is, what is your favorite ingredient and why?
Favorite ingredient would be pork. Yeah. It is a magical animal, and no other single ingredient can have so many distinct magical tastes and can be, you know, depending on who's coming to play, can make so many different flavors out of it. I mean, a pig in Bali versus a pig in Puerto Rico, they're two wonderfully unique things. You know, the difference between bacon and a stuffed pig's trotter. It's a whole universe of good stuff all in one animal. And
what's your favorite seasoning?
My favorite, salt.
If you could only, oh, salt.
You know, I love salt. You know, good crunchy sea salt, and I'd follow that up with, you know, roughly crushed black pepper. You know, it's almost all you need.
Somebody wants to know, going back, I know you don't want to do this, but to Rachel Ray, have you heard from her or any of her producers or any of?
Why I'm an insect on her you know radar screen. Why should she listen, you know, okay, to me? You know, she could easily, if she chose to, you know, have me killed with her, you know, what she spends on Triscuits every week, you know. And in fact, I'm a little concerned.
I'm glad I asked that.
Little list, you know, yeah. Groom dogs, buy Triscuits, mow lawn, have Anthony killed, you know, Manny Petty, you know.
People want to know what's next for you in terms of your travels.
Next, we're going to Laos and Tokyo, and in the can already. The first show of next season will be Singapore. A wonderful foodie wonderland, nice. if ever there was one. And just going to keep, you know, other shows: Papua New Guinea, Colombia, Spain. Hope to go to Sardinia.
Great. So the show is going to keep going on and on.
They just keep asking for more, and, you know, who am I to...
Yeah.
You know, how can I get off this pony? I mean, this celebrity chef scam is sweet.
Let me ask you then, though, because you now have a young daughter, 7-month-old daughter. Does this affect your traveling in any way? Are you going to bring your family along? Or
I'm trying to schedule a family-friendly location intermittently, you know, in between the Papua New Guinea shoot and the Colombia shoot. I'm going to try to, you know, do something closer to home or more family-friendly. I mean, she's from Italy, so, you know, they came along to the Tuscany show, obviously, and I stayed on with family and things after that. What has really changed? I mean, well, you know, they say when you have a child that it changes everything. Well, you know, I haven't smoked for 4.5 months.
Yeah.
Don't clap, self-righteous motherfuckers. I'm not happy. I would if I could. I just, you know, I had this terrible moment. You know, I couldn't smoke in the bar, couldn't smoke in the restaurant. Then the last line of defense, couldn't smoke in my apartment. I live in the 11th floor of an apartment building, and I found myself a grown man, a grown middle-aged man, down the hall from his apartment, standing in the stairwell, the fire stairs, smoking. And I suddenly hear a door open on the floor upstairs. And I, like, stub out the cigarette. I run out into the hall, and I'm standing there. And the door opens up, and it's the building manager. And he says, you know, there's no smoking in this building. And I'm like, you know, in the stairwell. I'm sorry, Mr. Dude. I mean, I felt like a teenager who was so undignified that led me to that humiliation. It's really a good motivator.
One of the bits of advice that you give at the end of your book, Kitchen Confidential, to aspiring chefs and people who work in kitchens is to never call in sick. Mm-hmm. And so that was a little bit disconcerting. Disconcerting. How sick do you have to be before you would not want someone in your kitchen?
Arterial bleeding, partial dismemberment, you know, maybe running sores, you know.
What about coughing a lot and sneezing? And
most people who work in kitchens can't afford to call in sick. You know, I mean, that's what we're talking about here. And the culture is very much, you know, that your kitchen crew is streamlined to only that number of people you need. In fact, fewer people than you need. You know, people work very hard in kitchens. So if somebody calls in sick, it's very, very hard to it means the people on both sides of you have to work twice as hard. And mm-hmm. you're very aware of that when you wake up with a cold. And mm-hmm. so chances are you work. Yeah. I mean, that's just the way it is.
You really amazed me when I was looking at your bio at how prolific you were as a writer, and especially reading your books and knowing how busy you were and all the, I mean, you talked about 17-hour days and 7 days a week and this incredible schedule where you would go home and, I mean, absolutely be totally exhausted. And I just want to know, how did you find the time to write books in between all that? And when you answer that question, also, how do you toggle back and forth between fiction and nonfiction? And do you plan to write any more fiction?
Well, I mean, I wrote Kitchen Confidential by just waking up early and writing for a few hours before I went to work. It helped that I didn't have any expectation of anyone ever reading the book. So I didn't put a lot of pressure on myself. You know, I wrote it exactly as I would have told those stories to my kitchen staff. I mean, I have a good work ethic. Writing, to be honest, is a hell of a lot easier than cooking. I know what work is. You know, to me, work is showing up, you know, to work a lunch counter in a restaurant you hate, you know, where you detest the very smell of the place. You know, it permeates your clothes and it depresses you and you feel, you know, bitter and humiliated even being there, but you show up every day and, you know, crank out 600 breakfasts. That's work. You know, I remember that feeling. Sitting down and writing for a few hours a day, you know, that's pretty easy. And I guess I've been so busy my whole life that if I do ever get time off, I get very unsettled, you know, laying there, you know, staring at the ceiling for over an hour. I need a project. I need something to do. And I think I'm aware that deep inside me there is a lazy hippie. You know, there is a little part of me that would like to just, you know, lay around smoking weed and watching The Simpsons all day. And I'm always looking for ways to outwit that person. You know, I need another project. I'm working on another novel now. I write novels because, let's face it, I mean, I wrote, you know me because of a book that I wrote about me, me, me. I travel around making a show about me, 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 and here I am talking about me, me, me. You know, it's nice to escape into an alternate universe now and again. So I really write the novels, you know, for therapy and as a relief.
Who's your favorite chef?
My favorite chef. I mean, if I've said that, I mean, I respect Thomas Keller. If we're talking about haute cuisine, I mean, I think he's as good as it gets. Uh-huh. And I have enormous, you know, my voice gets all trembly and squeaky whenever I meet him. I mean, we're friends now. I see him all the time, and I'm always going to get stuck, get all kind of the vapors around him. but my favorite chef is probably, if I were to die tomorrow, if I were execution planned, I would be eating at St. John Restaurant in London with my friend Fergus Henderson, who I just love his whole the fact that he could open up a spare white room with no pictures, no decoration, very simple table settings, and serve traditional country English food, much of it nose to tail, pork and squiggly bits, and make it so damn good, and so free of pretense, and so much fun. He would be my favorite chef.
That's interesting, because people don't usually associate the British with great cuisine. No, seriously. But a lot of people have asked, I know it's a silly question, but what is your favorite restaurant in San Francisco or the Bay Area?
You know, I love Swan Oyster Depot a lot. That's a good time for me. And Encanto, of course, you know, it figures that I would like Chris Cosentino. There's an international sort of a cult of hooves, snouts, and guts, and Chris Cosentino is the San Francisco chapter, the local capo of that particular chapter of this crime family. And in Montreal, you have Martin Picard at Au Pied Cochon, and in London, you've got Fergus, our sort of our godfather. And in New York, you got Mario Batali and this amazing chef, David Chang, who I love dearly. He started to get complaints that there weren't enough vegetarian options on his menu, so he changed the menu and rewrote it with pork in every course.
Yeah.
you got to love that.
Other than the jolt to your psyche, did you suffer any physical injuries as a result of your ATV rollover in New Zealand?
I emerged unscathed from the ATV thing. However, the combination of jumping out of a plane with the Flying Elvi skydiving team and a regrettable roller skating incident in L.A., I tore a rotator cuff, it hurts.
What's the best advice you have ever received? I'm assuming this means pertaining to
show up on time. The best advice I've ever received. It wasn't even advice. It was an order. It was if you're due in at 8 o'clock, you will show up at 8:15. If you show up at 8:14, I will send you home. If you show up tomorrow at 8:14, you will be fired. That was the best advice I ever got in my life. It instilled in me an absolute respect for arrival time. And an understanding also that what I was being taught here was a simple thing, and it's what I've always looked for in employees. You know, I can teach you to cook. You know, I can teach you if we spend enough time together. I can teach you to roast a chicken or properly pan roast a piece of fish or whatever else we have on the menu. Eventually, you'll get it. I can't teach character, and I need to find out sooner rather than later. Do you have the character for me to invest that time that I don't have in? And the best way to find out quickly about someone's character is, do you have enough respect for me and your coworkers to manage to show up on time every day? It's a simple thing. That made all the difference in the world to me as an undisciplined, angry, druggy, screwed-up kid for much of my life, and adult for that matter. That time when I decided that I would and could show up on time every single day, that was a big difference in my life. You know, I went home feeling proud of myself.
Oh. How come you couldn't identify Bigfoot?
He's not famous. You know, know the name. And, you know, if he's still up to those hijinks, you know, he might prefer to not be identified. Anyone who's worked anywhere near him knows who the guy is, but he's no one you'd know.
Here's a question. If you were on death row, what would your last meal be? I think we could eliminate the death row and just say, what would you like to have as your last meal? You were saying...
Roasted bone marrow, the roast veal bone marrow from St. John Restaurant with a little toasted French bread and some sea salt would be about as good as it gets. Failing that, you know, a nice, you know... Masa Takayama could drop by with some of that $300 a pound wholesale Otoro tuna with a little fresh wasabi. I wouldn't mind that.
Do you ever cook for a company? Do you have dinner parties where you're the chef?
You know what? I'm one of these guys. It is easier for me to cook for 500 people in a restaurant than to cook for 5 people at home. I'm a nervous wreck at home. And I, of course, leave it. You know, I'm used to having dishwashers and porters chasing after me and mopping my my brow and, you know, wiping things down. So I leave a trail of destruction behind me in the kitchen. Lately, it's become even more difficult. My wife is Italian, like from Italy. And so all the things that I used to cook at home, which were very, took real pleasure in making simple one-pot dishes like ossobuco or doing pasta, that's off the table now. You know, I don't speak Italian, but I know what schifezza means. And apparently it's not good. You know, my wife's one of these people who really, you know, for whom the only thing worse than an American is, you know, an Italian from the next village over. And
did you meet her?
Takes a dim view of cooking other than her own.
Did you meet her on one of your tours?
It was the first blind date of my life that Eric Repair's wife set us both up on. And, you know, it was, you know, a classic kind of, you know, Nora Ephron, meet cute. You know, two people not interested in a relationship who end up.
All right. Somebody commented, the last time you spoke at the club here, you mentioned the desire to move to Vietnam. Are you still interested in that?
Absolutely. As soon as my little girl toddles, as soon as they cancel this damn show, I still plan to go there for a year, between there and maybe a little time in Indonesia. And it's certainly Vietnam is, few places could be more family friendly and more of a child friendly. They adore children and indulge them. And I think it would be a very good place to spend a year if you were, a tiny little girl.
Yeah. Any desire to live in Italy?
I don't want to live in Italy, but I would like, I'm going to be spending a lot of, I've just married into a large Italian family. You know, I always was kind of deeply and secretly resentful of the fact that I wasn't Italian American. I always really wanted to be Italian American. And now I've sort of realized a dream by marrying into this, you know, enormous Italian and Sardinian family. And, yes, I will be spending a fair amount of time there. I mean, that doesn't suck, Italy, yeah. Okay? I'd never been, and I, you know, rented one of those wine label villas on a mountaintop in Tuscany, yeah. And, you know, boy, they're not lying. That place is great.
Yeah, yeah. You know, food's very, I mean, in international foods and international drinks, like ouzo is something I'm thinking of, that you know, it takes years sometimes for these things to come to America and to become very commonplace in this country. And somebody asked the question about, are there any foods that you've encountered overseas that you think we should be eating in this country or that will somehow make their way here and become very popular?
I'm not going to mention any specific dish, but what I think, if there's a big gaping hole in what we don't have, the style of eating, the style of establishment we don't have, that's unbelievable and shameful, is we do not have the Singaporean hawker center or the Malaysian hawker center. The most ingenious, wonderful concept is basically a large open area lined with stalls, one chef, one dish stalls. And what's great about these things is they're dirt cheap, cheaper than the Colonel, super fast, and, you know, one stall will be the duck guy. And this guy knows his duck. He's been roasting duck and doing nothing else for maybe three generations, so chances are he's pretty good at it. The chicken rice guy, the laksa guy, that wonderful mix of Malay, various types of Chinese food, and Indian, all in one place, all specialized stalls, eaten at like food court type situation. Man, do we need that.
Who is Andrew Zimmer, your copycat?
Andrew went to Vassar, I went to Vassar. Andrew went to CIA, I went to CIA. Andrew was a dope fiend, I was a dope fiend. They could improve the miking on the show. There's a lot of lip smacking on that show that's a little annoying. I like Andrew. He's a good guy. Our show's better. What can I say?
Yeah. How do you stay so thin?
I don't know. I used to say, you know, I figured it was the smoking. But I don't know. I don't snack ever. You know, like I don't ever, I'm not eating Cheetos in front of the tube ever. I don't really eat, I don't eat dessert. I'm just kind of oblivious to sweets. I mean, I like a little tiny bite of something sweet at the end of a big meal. I think basically a diet based around alcohol and animal fat seems to work, you know?
Yeah. We've reached that point in our program where we can only have time for one more question. I'm sorry to say, because this is going quite well. I wanted to ask you, I know there are a number of chefs in this room, and I just wanted to know what advice you would give them in terms of furthering their careers, whether they should get out now or what should they do?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, if you're a chef and you're here and you know, it's probably too late for you. You know, you're an addict. you know, you're either two types of people, and one of two types of people in this world. You're the sort of person who loves the speed, the futility, the relentlessness, the hopelessness, the inequity, the adrenaline crunch of the restaurant business. And then, you know, there's normal people, which are you. I think you probably already know that answer. As far as advice, you know, you try not to ever give up. Whatever standards you've adopted, you know, cling to those. And more than anything else, you know, have a sense of humor about things. As I'm sure you know, in the restaurant business, you'll need it. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Our thanks to Anthony Bourdain, chef, author, and world traveler. We'd also like to thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Narda Zucchino, and now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.